guys trouble there, but he was coming in at any time and take over the meeting. But we're trying to balance between that and the importance of time. And one of the things we need to do is that, well, my understanding is that we are going to start what I call a very... Are we meeting for the first time this year? We met yesterday in the portfolio committee. Oh, a third time today. Okay. My name is D. You want to make me think we had a meeting for the first time. Okay. Good morning, everybody. Can I take this opportunity to welcome all of us? Do we have any apologies? Oh, we have. I had an apology for ourselves that we've got a bigger challenge ahead, whether you call it Kilimanjaro or Himalaya, but it remains mountains. So we need to be geared for a tougher year. Maybe at some stage you might even, Honorable Ambrosin, consider working on a Saturday. I can see,
I'm only in favor of Saturday, but I know
that's what I've been told about. Maybe the chairperson will entertain you when he arrives. What I've been told by the team on the workshop is that there are the days during the week are so scarce that we might have to even look at the possibilities of discussing what extraordinary days we can use just for the workshop, because this workshop gives us an opportunity to deal with three-dimensional things, to assess where we are and where we come from, and then to develop a strategy around that, and then design a program that actually constitutes a vehicle that takes us forward. So it's a workshop that is necessary, so that we don't work in a spontaneous, what to call, fashion. That's introduction, just to sensitize ourselves. But having said that, I know what is going to keep us busy this week and next week and another weekend is personal, is protection of personal information. My understanding is that today we are going to do that vigorous exercise of clause by clause until we get to the end. Who that. Am I right?
We will attempt to do so.
Yes. You will facilitate. You will not lead. The committee will lead. Yeah. And then on each clause, and then we know the exercise. Can I hand over to the department to facilitate that? Thanks.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, on a point of procedure, I would like to address the committee on the issue of desirability, which is a preliminary issue before we go on a clause by clause.
Can you repeat that? I didn't hear you.
I would like to address the committee for 2.5 minutes, as soon as I get my papers from my from my secretary, on the issue of desirability. The issue of desirability will be of precise the analysis of clause by clause.
Does the committee have a problem with that? Proceed.
I'm just trying to get. I prepared a paper which has not arrived yet.
That is not a problem. But proceed anyway. Do you want to proceed under the
council? Yes, I will. And
as long as you just a point.
I feel like using my parliamentary privilege to tell you how terrible my secretary is, but. Since then I'm protected from the law of defamation, but it's absurd. We should have better staff. I mean, members of parliament are really disempowered by not having a competent secretarial assistant.
We are so fortunate the chairperson has arrived at the time when we're about to start. I can easily make my life easy. I just want to say to the Honorable Chair, as he is about to take over, that we were about to start. I did give you apologies. We are about to start, and we have agreed that we'll be going clause by clause. But you enter at a point when Honorable Amrusini was asking to address the committee for 2.5 minutes on this approach of clause by clause. We were allowing him to do that, to hear what he has to say. The only disability he had is his paper, which he was supposed to circulate amongst us. But again, it's him who gets disadvantaged, it's not us. And I thought we could still proceed with that if he is willing to go ahead. But at that point, I'll hand over to you and also extend my apology that there has been a discussion between the chairperson and the SCOPA. That it would be prudent if I attend the SCOPA meeting.
Compliment Honorable Amrusini, I haven't seen you there. And to the rest of those I haven't seen, somewhere together yesterday. Thank you very much. I'm sure we can proceed. You're on the floor. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. I promise that I will keep my presentation to 2.5 minutes and I will try to do so. My presentation is assisted by a document of 18 pages, which my secretary was supposed to photocopy, and she hasn't, and I hope it will be arriving. So I will make reference to to this document. I would like at this juncture, if you can just picture it on your mind. It's a document of 18 pages, which I gave to Ananda in December, with all the provisions of this deal, 18 pages, which apply to each and every of you, to each Rolodex, to each cell phone of each person, unless the person is not economically active, and even irrespective of registration. The issue of registration doesn't apply. If you need to register in terms of the act, then there will be more provisions over and above these 18 pages of provisions. Those are obligations which go on and on. And they are under penalty of incarceration. If people do not comply with those 18 pages, they will be incarcerated. It's a criminal offense. It applies to all the SSMEs, the cooperatives, the ladies on the road of KwaZulu-Natal going to Ulundi, who sells potatoes and avocados by the side of the street, if she's got phone numbers of customers. Now, and I speak to the colleagues of the NC, you have the power, you make the decisions. We see our role not to hinder your decision making, but making sure that what you decide, you get what you want. And my intervention is to make sure that that is what you want. And because there are enormous unintended consequences, I try to correct this approach of the bill, which is a universal approach. It's not correctable within the structure of the bill. We saw the same thing when we went to England. Universal approach, their solution is fine, but we only enforce it where we feel it ought to be enforced. So the approach is to criminalize everyone and then casting the net wider and wider when there is a public need of enforcing the law. And when so when it comes to the famous Taylor Butcher and Street Vendor, there is no interest, so the law is not enforced on them. So this system of universal approach applies only in respect, works only if there is selective enforcement. I find that very problematic. So in point of desirability, I think that the committee should apply its mind to whether or not we really want this universal approach, or should we not ask for a sectorial approach, which is more balanced, is what is used in different countries other than Europe and Australia. And the sectorial approach can be achieved in two different ways. Either by...
I was told we're given 2 minutes.
Have I already... Okay.
That has expired.
Okay, can I complete the sentence?
Yeah.
The sectorial approach can be achieved either by having sectorial laws or by only having the bill apply there where the regulator adopts a code. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I make this submission.
Thank you very much. Just a correction. We're not sitting here then to make decisions. We're a committee of Parliament. And if the NC comes in here and thinks that he's making decisions on behalf of the committee, it's very mistaken. we're here to all of us work to answer and convince one another if this is. Arguments make sense. We must listen to them. Thank you. JJ?
Yeah, I think sometimes the opinion made is using dropping words in the paper later like that, when the IFC was in control. Having...
Professor, Mr. Chairman.
Having said that, I think that... Okay, Dr. Amrassini has put it as an issue of the desirability of control. City, we can't see the document. But although I feel we need to proceed with the bill, I do have sympathy for what he's saying. The difference maybe I'm wrong, but I wouldn't see it as a major change. I also have a problem with a bill that casts the net so wide that it's unenforceable. But the approach I would favour is omnibus legislation that we've got, but effectively dealing with the principles, the major exemptions, and then setting up the regulator, and the power of law, the making of the law, the implementation of the law effectively, done by the regulator through the code. So you therefore can, within what the law is doing, is setting up a framework. Creating the regulator and setting up a framework of broad principles and general exemptions, within which the regulator then can produce the codes which are effectively the enforceable aspects of it. And I would have seen that approach as being possible. So my problem with the bill at the moment is we've raised it before, that I think it although it claims to be a principle-based approach, it ends up restricting a lot of, going further than principle. It specifically restricts a lot of things that are unimplementable. We had the problem of, and I still think it's covered, door-to-door canvassing and recording what people say to you when you go to the political party to canvass. There's a lot of things like that. But anyway, that's the approach I would have thought of. So I don't know where you want to take the decision. see just some general views, and we haven't also, just so that Dr. Umbertini is here, I mean, I'm talking on an individual position, we don't have a party position on this. Because in the ANC you discuss things, you don't get told this is the line. So basically just that is a
thank you, sir. May I just say that I find this useful because it gives us a chance to see where our thinking is going. I need to say as a member of Parliament, I've never done anything else in 20 years for Dr. Umbertini's benefit. And we do that as individual MPs, and at some point we confer and we decide on a position. Natasha Michael and I have in fact conferred in January, so what I'm going to say is based on our concurrence. It seems to me what we should do, and I follow now from John Jeffrey, is take the approach taken in the UK Act, which I like a lot. By the way, a lot of what is in the whole second half of the bill I think is fine, and we're not going to have that much work, except for some basic issues, very big ones, imprisonment, for example, which I don't think we should do yet. But why don't we, and I think this would go with John Jeffrey's approach, why don't we deal with it the way the UK has done. You make your simple statement of principles, there they are. You don't elaborate or try to apply under each principle. There's your statement of principles. Then you do the conditions relevant in schedules. The first set of conditions relevant are the ones that apply to all principles. The second lot applies to sensitive personal information. And here as there, one should have to comply with only one condition relevant before you can start from the principle. Then I would suggest when it comes to the sensitive personal information, which John has also just referred, the thing about the political parties and churches, I would delete the entire part B of whatever the section was, sensitive personal information. Delete the whole part B, all of those prohibitions, take them out. And we deal separately and very similarly to the UK with media. In the case of political parties and churches, you must allow people their democratic and proselytizing rights. And again, I like the English approach, although I would take out some of their provisions. So it's a simpler, cleaner approach to the whole thing. We don't try to elaborate too much. We don't try to nail down too many things up front in our principles. And we have many more proposals, but that's just a pick off because I think there's a degree of similar thinking going on.
So yes, I think we are reaching a convergence of views on this issue, and I want to support what the previous speakers have said. We share the concerns about the broad ambit of the bill and unintended consequences in particular, and that we need to relook at it. And I particularly want to endorse what Honourable Dean has just said, to relooking at a more streamlined version, simple statements of principle, the conditions that you refer to, and of course, which obviously close to our hearts, is the issue of the churches and the political parties. That aspect is very important. So I do think that it's an issue that we need to seriously consider, and I think it obviously then will impact what we're going to do this morning, because as I understand it, the initial intention was to go through clause by clause, but we will need then to re-look at exactly what we're going to do. Are we going to take some time? Are we going to re-draft? How is the framework going to look? And I think we need to discuss that if we are. And I understand that you might not have taken a study group decision on this issue. You might need time for that. But I think that we need to consider these, particularly in view of what JJ has said, understanding again that it's not a corporate judicial necessarily, but one needs to seriously consider where are we going with this legislation. Thank you, Ken.
Listening to input generally, the question was beginning to arise that what do we do with the agencies in our close by close? But maybe we should follow what you are saying and see if we don't agree on principles. This is the main approach that we'll do. Otherwise, we're going to waste our time going through clause by clause, which clauses we may not even use. So let's just try and shift the discussion to what are the key points of agreement. terms of approach, what must go in, what must stay out. What must go in, what must stay out. And let's see how far we go with that. And if we agree on what comes in, what goes out, then we'll decide whether we want to go on clause by clause. But we could focus on the clauses that we think must go in, having agreed on. So we say what goes in, what stays out. Then we look at what goes in, then we go on those clauses of what goes in. So I think that's the basic process at the moment. I don't know if the department wants to say anything. That's one thing to, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Maybe just from the department side and with respect to the board as is before the committee, you will recall during our briefing. And I'm specifically trying to address the issues raised by Mr. John Jeffries, because I think that's the closest to what we have at this stage. I'm not saying exactly that. But you will recall during our briefing, we indicated that, first of all, we must recognize that we have framework legislation that we would like to get implemented. We also specifically emphasized, and it was also referred to, reference to the importance of the regulator. Enforcing the provisions of the law was highlighted. We also stated that for the advantage of the committee that we felt that the role of the regulator is extremely important. In that regard, I would just like also to mention, and maybe the comparison might assist the committee, when the promotion of access to information law or the open democracy law was considered by the committee. I recall that on more than one occasion, the committee members said to themselves that we must take into consideration that it might appear to be drastic provisions being applied to all and sundry, but we must take into consideration that we are creating a new regime. And that was the information regime that was created. So the committee members have realized that, and well, I can't speak for them, but that is the impression that I got when they said that a new regime must be created, is that implementation will be important, but there will be birth pains as well. Certain things will have to be monitored to see how it happens in practice before one can really address that. The concern was raised that the street vendor might also fall under the ambit of the bill. Exactly the same concern was under the Access to Information Act, and there was a method of addressing that. So it's something that, to a large extent, possibly can be that we will be guided by the committee. Mr. Chair, I just mentioned that maybe to give you an indication that when I personally first looked at the bill and when we started processing the bill, once again got the impression that this is now a new regime that must be created. Strictly speaking, it's something that is actually supposed to happen. Your personal information is supposed to be protected on a daily basis by those other parties who process it. But just to highlight that we felt, and we mentioned it, as well as the law, that the role of the regulator would be extremely important in creating this regime. You will recall, and I promise I will try not to do that too much, but you will recall when we met the Information Commissioner, I asked him one question, and that was when they started with their office, when they started their work, was there sort of, from that stage up to now, a natural evolution? And I tried to explain it by indicating that we start off by trying to get cooperation from everyone, start off by educating the public, etc., and that you eventually go over into more of an enforcement role. The answer that we got was that they started with everything and tried to apply equally all their responsibilities and functions. But I foresee that the approach in South Africa might be a bit different. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I misled this committee. My apologies. The document was not 18 pages, but 12 pages. But this applies to all of you, applies to all the members of the media, it applies to Mr. Bernie, to Bonani, applies to all of us. So we better read it very, very carefully, because you break it, you're a criminal, Mr. Chairman. And that's the way it is. If this bill passed, we are all criminalized. But I'd like to take exception as gently as I can, Mr. Chairman, to what the department said. Philosophically, information is free. This is my role in it. I collected this information. These are all my numbers, my professional numbers. If I want to give them to the members of the media because I like them, I should be able to do so. Those of us who are children of the French Revolution believe that information belongs to mankind. Knowledge belongs to mankind. So for that to be restricted, there must be a reason. The principle is freedom. Restriction is the exception. So there must be some pain. So I have difficulty with the approach of saying this is a new regime. Now, henceforth, information is prohibited unless permitted. No, information is permitted unless prohibited. And that's what this bill does. So philosophically, we need to apply our mind as a committee, whether we share the approach the department just gave us. All information is to be regulated. Henceforth, all information is regulated. There is a regulator. It is the triumph of the dynamic state, and he'll tell you how to deal with your information and how you need to use it, because information is all going to be non-public. Your own personal information that you have personally collected within your business. So this, I'd like to go back to John Jeffrey's approach, which I think could take us forward. And I allow me, Honorable Jeffrey John, to rephrase it just to understand it, if I didn't understand it correctly. What John was suggesting is that one could take out the prescriptive part of the bill, leave it to what it was supposed to be, just principle. So all the 12 pages would become principle. And then the regulator implements those principles through calls, applying on a sectorial basis. And those calls are the law. These are the principles. Regulator adopts the calls. Those calls are the law. And if the regulator gets it right, is wise, and consults sufficiently, will not impose an obligation on you and I, Mr. Chairman, and the lady selling potatoes on the road to Yolunda in KwaZulu-Natal, that will go where the pain exists and where it needs to be addressed. So if I understood correctly, Mr. Jeffrey, I think that approach is very, very meritorious.
Luckily, we don't have a presidential conference coming up. Otherwise, I would be maybe in trouble with Dr. Umbridge agreeing with me. So much, but yeah, I think there would be a common approach. Basically, that, and I think it's also what Dean had said. Because the problem with the bill maybe just one point disagreeing with the department. It's fine for PIA to apply to everything because that's access to information, and you don't necessarily want information from the and maybe there were exemptions, but you don't necessarily want information from the informal trader who sells apples at the bus stop. The difference with this bill is it's not providing for access to information. It's restricting. And there's, I think, a fundamental problem with making something illegal, or restricting it, when that's unnecessary. So I have sympathy with, I think, Dr. Albertini. Sorry, when did you last go to Urundi? With the issue of the informal trader, what is it, the potato seller on the road to Urundi?
For your information, we're in Rome and London together. It was not in London.
Yeah, no, I don't think I've seen the town for a long time. Don't tell the leader that.
Protection, Mr. Chairman.
you know, the basically that would, you know, so instead of saying, look, you may access this information, but nobody will want to, what the department, where this bill is different, is saying you may not release this information, and it's illegal to, or it could be illegal to do so. So I think that's the sort of difficulty. But I think the general approach would be, which I think there's a common understanding of, is basically principles. So we keep your eight principles, but we make them principles. And at the moment, I think we'd raised in the earlier discussions that there's a confusion between a principle and the implementation of that principle. We make them broad guides under these eight categories, but possibly broader. We then have your specific exclusions, and then we have you've got your general exclusions and your specific exclusions. Then you have the regulator and the process. And maybe there's a clause in the beginning explaining how this is going to work. Because if that was the intention, as Henk says, you've got to wade through a lot of paper to find that. You know, there should be a thing in the beginning saying this is how this bill is going to work. These are the regulator, which will introduce codes. That's dealt with in these sections, the process about how they will produce the codes in these sections. The codes must conform with the following principles that they're being dealt with, subject to general exclusions and specific exclusions. And I would have suggested that being the framework. And there are then points within that around, you know, there's the whole debate around natural and juristic persons. Debate around the media, there are some of those kinds of things we would still need to resolve. But I think, if I'm correct, that there was consensus largely on that being the broader approach. So it's not that much of an overhaul. It's a restructuring, effectively.
Thank you very much. Just before saying what I wanted to say in response to both gentlemen, can I just do an approach on the matter of the derivative. If Dr. Ambrosini, who first made the argument that we have no choice, the Constitution includes derivative. But we would like to argue as follows. As the Constitutional Section 8, Section 8 binds juristic persons if and to the extent applicable, right? Taking into account the nature of the rights. But juristics are bearers of a right to the extent required by the nature of the right and the nature of the jurisdiction. And I think we precisely are the people who must decide when it is applicable and when it is required. And we argue that the jurisdictions are bound as empire, as a private body, for example, they're there to give information. They are bound insofar as they compile data about persons. But they are not themselves bearers of the right to personal privacy. And if I'm right, that's where the difficulty arose. Right? So take them out. We are in a position to take them out. Right? So I think that issue is not so difficult to dispose of on our argument. Just on the other matter of this all being too wide, just and before I make a specific point, a specific problem.
Just the heuristics. What are the indicators of what they're saying? Let's just flag it. We'll come back to it.
On the matter of the thing being too wide, don't forget the very real problems. I've been reading the consumer papers in the newspaper since we started working on this. And you have cases like the young lady who said she just clicked on when she got one of these spam messages on her phone. And the next thing, someone was running a debit order off her bank account. She had at no point given out her banking details. And she then pursued, a lot of these stories, you can read them every week. She then tried to pursue how these people, who they were, where they were, how they got her details, got highly evasive answers, and it turned out they had bought the data, a list of people's banking details from some central people that are supposed to deal with. All right, and Mark Haynes has told us there have been six major breaches of security. In the last year. So I think it's important. important in here somewhere that the rights of the data subject should be stated upfront in the bill. It's supposed to be protecting people against automated decision making about their lives, careers, futures, and as a mechanism, the consent mechanism under which you or I can go to the regulator and say, my informational privacy rights have been breached, and do something about it. That's terribly important. And I would like to see a whole upfront statement, again, as in the UK, about the rights of data subjects. But now, just on the subject of the thing being too wide, it seems to me that something that got lost in the drafting is that we're dealing with the consequences of computerization and automation. And I think, look at our clause 3. That matter that dealing with automated, predominantly automated information, is buried in the application clause. And the application clause is really about the territorial implications. But buried in there, under B, we suddenly find, using automated or non-automated means, it's the only setting out of the subject of automation and filing systems that are designed to be fed into automated systems that I can really find in the book. And I think we need to think whether we don't want upfront a statement about what it is we're dealing with. I know that we're also dealing with all data. Informational privacy rights apply to everything. But I think part of the reason why this bill seems to be too wide is that we've kind of lost the computerization justification. And look at the UK. The very first basic interpretive provision in this Act, data means information which is being processed by means of equipment operating automatically in response to instructions given. B is recorded with the intention that it should be processed by means of such equipment. C is recorded as part of a relevant filing system or with the intention that it should form part of. D does not fall within A, B, or C, but forms part of an accessible record as defined by 68, and that those are health records, educational, social service records of the government. It seems to me we kind of lost that, and that much could be restored by splitting our clause 3 into two separate ones, and then further, by cleaning up and tightening up a few of our definitions. For example, record. Is it really necessary to include under record if we need a definition for record at all? Everything, labels, photos, full, negative, is this really needed? I know you're going to tell me Google snaps of people's number plates or people standing outside their house, one set into a computer safe, might be also an issue. But do we really need this vastly expansive definition? Do we even need the vastly expansive personal information definition, which is directly from FIRE, I think? But FIRE serves slightly other purposes. So maybe we can tighten up a little bit and make it clear that the whole reason why this kind of law came into existence is computerization and automation. And maybe if we make that clearer, it also helps.
I think that the only point that I would like to make is I don't think it will make any difference to the bill if we change format of it. So I would be happy with any sort of format that you would be comfortable with. That's not a problem for me. The only why we actually thought that it would be a good idea to look at this in a clause by clause fashion, even though it may be changed in a way, is because of the fact that up to now what has happened is that we have had very sort of general discussions. And also the people who came in, the public who came in and made their submissions sort of stated, made a lot of statements, and quite often these statements are simply not true, talking about unintended consequences, but never really unpacking that and looking at it and see what is the unintended consequence and is it really an unintended consequence. We haven't really done that. It's always been sort of a general discussion with also each person speaking, talking about 10 to 15 things in that one submission that he made. And then we haven't gone into, made a list of those 10 things and discussed each of them and got to the bottom of each of them. So I think that there are many things that are simply sort of taken as for granted, which is not true, or which in context would be different to understand. So that's why we thought if we went through each clause, one clause by clause, and establish whether what we understand in that clause is actually what is being said, and if what is being said is true. And I'm going to refer to just one example just now, which is as a general discussion. Then it would be easier for us to understand what this is about, and then perhaps to reshuffle it and put it in the format that we would like. So that is what we are not sort of suggesting that the format is now cast in stone and that we must have a clause-by-clause discussion and then everything is finished. It's just that we thought that it would be, everybody would understand better what the issues are once we've actually discussed one thing at a time, you know, and concluded, you know, one issue at a time rather than discussing everything very superficially and coming to some conclusion. For example, the example that I would like to refer to is, for instance, the whole idea of the criminalization and the fact that the gap is very wide and that the principles are draconian in nature. Actually, first of all, the principles are not draconian, they are actually just good business practice. They are things that should be happening at the moment already. And as we've worked with people in the field, they are actually using many of the, or almost all of them, if they are big, like banks and so forth, are already implementing the bill as it is at the moment, voluntarily. They are really not asking someone to keep the information safe or try to keep it accurate and to do all of those things are not draconian in nature, especially since there are so many exceptions within the principle which make provision for reasonably practicable, easy possible to do so, insofar as possible for you to do so, etc. So they are not really draconian. Secondly, insofar as the enforcement is concerned, what if I can just give one line, explain it in one line. What happens is that if you do not comply with the principle, if a responsible party does not comply with the principle, then they will get a notice. Well, first of all, somebody would complain and they would get an information notice, which already will give them an indication that they are being investigated. If it is found that there is an effect, that are in fact doing something wrong, they will receive a notice indicating to them that they have put the position right. If they don't do so, or if they don't agree with the notice, they have the opportunity to appeal to the court. First of all, there will be mediation and conciliation, and they will try, that's what the Act makes provision for. So when the complainant comes to the regulator will first try to solve the problem by way of mediation and conciliation. That's what the Act provides for. If that's not possible, the regulator will send a notice of enforcement which tells the responsible party to do something or to stop doing something. The responsible party then has the opportunity to the judge's court to appeal to court if nothing can be done to solve it internally. And then only if the court then says that you should comply with it, and he doesn't comply with it, then it becomes a criminal offence. Or if he does absolutely nothing, if he just ignores the regulator, if he doesn't want to come to negotiations, if he doesn't reply to the enforcement notice, if he doesn't appeal to the court, if he does absolutely nothing, after he's been noted that there's something wrong, he's doing something wrong, then it becomes a criminal investigation. And then he goes to court, and then he must explain to court why on earth he has not complied with anything or why he hasn't done anything. So it's not really saying that each person on the corner who doesn't, do something wrong is going to court to jail. I mean, that's a huge overstatement. So that's just one of the things, but I mean, many of these things are raised in with 10 other issues, and we never get to the bottom of each little aspect that's being raised, and then we just move on to another one, and next time we do that again. And that's why we thought that if we really go into the Act and discuss each and every section, then understanding of what it is. And then that can be rearranged in which way we like, because there's no prescript as to how this helps you when it starts. I would be happy with any sort of format.
I've got a list. And I just want to say we are agreed on a regulator. That's a firm agreement that we'll have a regulator. That one I'm clear with, like, where I agreed on that one. Very good. Yeah. Yeah. So we are agreed on a regulator. So what is it that regulator is to do? Can we agree on that? Look at the process quickly. What is it that the regulator needs to do? Because I'm looking at rewriting. Sorry? Yeah.
It just was that I have a problem with what has been said. The Law Commission is there to do research. Forward that to the department, to the minister, comes into to the parliamentary process as legislation is built. Once the bill is with Parliament, it belongs to Parliament. So I want to make it quite clear that there's not an issue of us as the Law Commission agreeing on things, okay? And the we that Ananda refers to, there's no we. It's us, okay? Not you, us. Okay, we're the elected people for that. And the issue basically is that I appreciate you've put an incredible amount of work into this through the Law Commission. But I just have a difficulty if we're going to find that every change we want to make, we have to actually then listen to. I mean, we've been with this bill for some time, maybe not as long as you have, but we have engaged with it, listened to all the views. I think we're generally open about the thing, far more open, unfortunately, than somebody who sat with the bill for years. But it's just going to be a problem if every time we want to make a change, we've got to have this sort of lengthy defense of what was there. So I really think that we need to look at the process issue. We are dealing with this bill as we are elected to. And we can have input and we obviously need help with drafting. But I don't think that we've got to be careful about people who are effectively married to the content. So that's my concern. I just wanted to raise that. I can respond then to your point that you said you had a speaking list, but I just thought that on a process point of view. Okay,
process as well.
Yeah.
I like the notion of peace and holding issue. The Honourable Mac raised the issue of the application to legal entities. My suggestion, Mr. Chairman, is twofold. I seem to record that the committee is in agreement to limit the application of the protection to legal entities if permissible under the Constitution. So the issue becomes a legal issue and a constitutional issue. So instead of, which requires some discussion, I heard what's been said, I don't want to engage in a dialogue. So my suggestion is that perhaps you, Mr. Chairman, could task two or three people within this committee to look at that from a legal perspective and report to you. So that then we can look at whether or not we have the latitude of pursuing that from a policy viewpoint. That's one issue. The other issue, which is also foundational within the type of discussions we are having, I mean, the one is the one of the regulator, what it's going to do, the scope of application. The other one is the issue of government and the philosophy of this bill. From my viewpoint, and historically, the greatest threat to individual privacy comes from the misguided action of government. In most countries, government is prevented from collecting data of all types. Here, government is excluded. So we wouldn't, and it's excluded over and above the entitlement it has under any law. So when government is a statutory function to collect information to implement that law, it's excluded. But this would exclude government. Also, when government collects information which is not already authorized under existing laws passed by parliament. So that's, I think that that's another area of general concern on the scope of the bill. And so I'll stop at that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Am I talking?
I
forgot another point. Allow me, since nobody else took the. If I can just extend my privilege of the floor.
But nevertheless, I extend it.
Mr. Chairman, your generosity will go down in history. Now, the other point, and I made this before, I really think that we should not pass on this opportunity to give a statutory enunciation of the right to privacy. I accept that there is the constitutional right, but then that constitutional right gets implemented to legislation. The legislation is not the beginning and the end of that right, because the constitutional right will expand as much as the constitutional right is capable of expanding. And it is not going to be the only act in which the right to privacy is enunciated. But in respect of the collection of information, I think it's important that provision be made for the right of people to say no when information is sought. So that, especially in commercial transactions, people should only be authorized to ask you the information which is germane and relevant to the type of commercial transaction you're about to enter. Since this bill has been tabled in Parliament, I've begun paying attention to how many times when you go and buy things or you go to a hotel, they ask you all sorts of information which has got nothing to do with the information, with the transaction you're entering into. And all that information gets stored. And it is not sufficient that then it gets protected under the bill. One should be able to say, no, I'm not giving it to you. Close the proverbial curtain onto the people looking into the room, into the bedroom. Thanks.
Christian, you wanted to come in? Okay. The second point of agreement, this subject of confirmation. We agree on the regulator. The regulator needs to do certain things to implement the principles. So it seems to me like, in general terms, we are agreeing on the act being a set of principles. I want to get the response from the department on that one. But first, from us as a committee, is that a correct reflection of where we're going? Is it?
Yeah. I also, because I travel a lot, I have to stay in hotels, and I often ask strange questions. So maybe it's just Dr. Ambrosini and the particular profile, and therefore ask him all these weird questions. I think if one looks at the bill, Chapter 5, which is the regulator, I mean, obviously one would need to go through these clause by clause, which would deal with the appointment and things like that. Chapter 6, which is the investigations by the regulator, and the Code of Conduct, Chapter 7, would, I think, be things that would need to remain in the bill. Obviously, going through clause by clause, I mean, I think that there would be general agreement around, I mean, a simple one, the appointment of the regulator processes. So that's the regulator. Then I think it's a thing of the nine principles which are effectively the EU, eight principles which are effectively EU principles. Those we need to follow, but we would need to look quite carefully at the wording so that it is principle based, not going too specific. Because the idea would be, you're saying to the regulator, you're going to draw up codes which will make the law. You make those codes to comply with these principles. So they need to be principles and not not the code itself. And then you've got the whatever you'd want to call it, the absolute exclusions and the specific exclusions.
Just on the codes, what is the procedure of making those codes? Then we need to be brought in as committee at the stage of making codes. I'm asking because yesterday we were sitting in another meeting and there were regulations which were coming back to us. Would it be the same procedure or what is the story? What are we going to do about it?
I wouldn't actually. Look, in principle, it's a good thing when we require subordinate legislation to come to us, but there's a limit to what we can do. And if you set up the regulator correctly and require it to go through a good number of procedural fairness steps every time before it makes its code, and you should leave them to do it. We're giving it the power to make those codes, to delete them. And what's already in the bill we can use, it says, before you make any kind of a code, you must make sure that all the stakeholders, all the relevant people, have been consulted, or you publish your draft and give people a chance to comment. We could expand that process. ICASA has something but twice or three times as long, just to make, that's why ICASA always takes long, because we've legislated it that way. Just to make sure you give everybody a chance and that you achieve the best end product. So we could expand the process, but it also has downside. And then by the end of that, everybody has been consulted. We, as a committee, would not have had the benefit of all of the consultative cycles. And therefore, you know, far be it from me ever to say, no, don't let, you know, in principle, it's a good idea when Parliament looks at things. But in practice, I would say, give your regulator enough power, build in enough administrative procedural fairness steps, and then let him write the code and give it some.
Yes, it's still on there. No, I just interrupted you on the regulator, but
The issue around the adoption of the codes is a detail we can come to later. I think it's a question of the restructuring of the bill.
Yeah, just on this issue of the regulator, because also this is cornerstone discussion. I agree with both the Honourable Jeffrey without fear of agreeing and with the Honourable Smith without fear of agreeing. The, I think what we have here is fine, except that it could be expanded. The notice and comment process is conceptually sound. It could be made stronger, and then when we put our feet in it, we can look at how to do so. But it should, the code should have the legal status of a regulation, and there should not be regulation. So that the regulator is a regulatory agency, adopt the regulation. I'm concerned about the provision where the where regulations can just be passed the old way. And on this, if I can just use one sentence, Mr. Chairman, to point out how there is a movement within South African legislation from the old style of secondary legislation, where the minister provides a CC fit for anything which is pertinent to the implementation of the act, to what is done internationally on notice and comment, a secondary regulation, which is a matter of substance. And there is necessity to that, because as society develops, laws become more and more generic, more and more just enunciation of principles. And the actual substance of that which controls the life and the rights of citizens is in the regulation. So the regulation cannot be left to the unfettered discretion of the minister to do anything he wishes for as long as not contra-virus or ultra-virus, and it is within the cornerstone of the act. So in that sense, this is an important step legislatively to move in that direction, which should not be undermined by the residual power of regulation of the minister.
Thank you. take many, many months. So that's...
Yeah. With this discussion in mind, should we now go back to the process?
I
was thinking of going to take a shortcut, but I realized maybe let's just go through it. I think because we have had broad discussions, I think we are more or less, we would know which losses not to focus on. Quickly say, let's keep this one. I don't know. What do
you think? What I wanted to suggest, because I think that you were so clever in saying, we want a regulator, yes. Now, what do we want to do? And I think the first clause we could possibly look at, if you want, is the powers and duties of the regulator, which is clause 43, page 22. Because that's one way of...
They should, the department, they should.
I'm sorry, point of clarity, are we going from clause 43 or from clause 1?
No, I think I'm happy for us to focus on the regulator, and then if we are done with that, we might have to reduce the load of work on all the other processes going on. That's what was exercised in my mind. Honorable Ambrosin?
Yes, then if we look at this bond to then look at 43, trying to capture what the Honorable Chief and the Honorable Dean were saying in actual amendment, then all 43 would stay, save for the fact that the main power, and actually it's a function, because it's a function of the regulator, is that of implementing the principles into code of conduct. So it needs to adopt code of conduct which implement the principle. Actually, number one would be identifying the sectors in which code of conduct are appropriate. And number two, implement the principles in respect of those sectors by means of a code. Thank you.
Okay, that's extremely useful, but surely we go beyond that, Mario, because now you want your regulator to go under D to monitor and enforce compliance. You remember what the English have just done under that coroner's and justice bill. They've now expanded their information commissioner's power to carry out an independent assessment to determine whether a public body has complied with data protection principles and issue an assessment notice which will require the relevant body to take remedial action. It's precisely the government departments, the ones that are excluded in this draft against everybody's wishes. The UK has established they need their information commissioner to go in there, audit and assess. And just imagine the need in this country, because we know what happens to data banks in home affairs and in the set.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I was not clear. I said 43 is fine. All that would be covered. The issue being raised is about the exclusion. But once the exclusion clause is fixed, 43D will take care of that, because it's whatever is the act. My suggestion was to have a section before, which is the sanction of the regulator. These are the powers and duties. And the other, well, actually, it's just the powers and duties. The other one is the function. One, to identify the sectors which require regulation. Two, implement the principles by means of code in those sectors.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
The regulator is not only looking at protecting personal information and code stuff, also doing access to information. So we start looking at that, and we just maybe clarify whether we want to actually do it.
Okay.
you made a mistake by leaving the mic on, Christine.
Yeah.
That's it. Don't have a receiving.
Use your own.
Take it, please, because that's why it's red.
No, but that actually doesn't matter, because the implementation of the principle is the function. Then we can put the number 3, and we make reference to the other function of access to information. I think that's another issue which has to be discussed. I don't have a view, so I didn't raise it, whether or not we want to move the PIA functions to the regulators or leave them where they are. I couldn't make my mind. But if it is left as proposed here, there would be an additional function which is provided for. It would not alter how the regulator exercises the function in respect of the protection of private information and the structure of the bill, as John was suggesting, where they are the principles and they are implemented through code.
I mean, it was on the issue of the overlap with PIA. And I mean, specifically the representations we've had from ODAC. My concern is that I think that, I mean, PIA has been in operation for, what, 10 years? We passed it in 2000. I'm not sure how long it's been in operation for then, but just under 10 maybe. I think it needs to be looked at. I think there's a lot of areas for improvement, particularly the enforcement angle or aspect. But I'm very reluctant to put that into this bill. From the point of view, we're doing something new in terms of a regulator to protect information. To then give that regulator, that body, we're setting up new functions right at the beginning, when we don't even know if it's going to work on the protection aspect, I think is dicey. So I would want to say that I'm very sympathetic to ODAC's position, but I'm not particularly keen on doing that now in this bill. I would rather have seen that we focus on the regulator protecting information, doing all these things if we want to, and then maybe as part of the committee report, calling for a review of PIA. It's one of the fundamental pieces of legislation of our democracy provided for in the Constitution, saying that Parliament should review PIA, and in that review we can then see how we improve on it. And once that review is completed, the regulator should be up and running, and one can then see, does one want to give additional functions? Because I think the bottom line is that when you have a dispute around access to information, you don't have it's not particularly easy to resolve it. But giving that responsibility to the regulator at this point, when you don't know how the regulator is going to work in practice, I think it's dicey.
But I think the idea of a regulator is acceptable, even with regard to PIA. But I think JJ is correct that we don't conflict that.
May I address on this issue, Mr.
Yeah.
Chairman?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
Thank you. I accept what, and I say I don't have a specific view, I haven't applied my mind sufficiently, but I accept what John is saying. My only concern is that it's very difficult to get a second bite at the same legislative cherry. I mean, once we are doing it, then you go back and you need to move it. I mean, PIA, it could be a different bunch of people doing it. It's difficult. Perhaps consideration could be given to a sunrise provision in terms of which the transfer of functions from the Human Rights Commission to the regulator is provided for in the bill, but activated, operationalized at a later time when the following conditions are met, the existence of which to be determined by, could be the resolution of both houses of parliament or something. We need to look at the technicalities to be consistent. So if we set criteria, when X, Y, Z happen, then parliament intervenes and brings into force a set of provisions that we have already agreed to in this venue.
Let me just
that's not the, the opposite view. See, I don't think we're going to have access to information in South Africa until we have a regulator to make binding decisions. Our access to information in the regime now is characterized by mute refusal, which means nobody answers, nothing happens. And so I don't think we're going to have access to information. And certainly we should, Dr. Albertini's proposal is good for the transfer of the SAHRC functions. I think they should be transferred. And maybe the Sunrise little mechanism is good to dissuade Don Jeffries' concern, which I must admit were kind of persuasive. But Chair, so from our side, we want access to information in South Africa. It's not happening, and we're creating a regulator dealing with information. So maybe we'd like to not wipe that off the table right away. Think about it some more. Maybe we can give that a Sunrise.
Okay, it's an issue we'll come back to. Let's look at issues where I agree, where there's consensus. Then we're going back to 40, the same, we're looking at the regulator. Somebody must have walked us through. Are there any other issues that we're going to discuss regarding the regulator? And the department is just through already, or anything else. I see, Dr. Brosin is actually leading us through 43, so maybe you should take the floor and walk us through.
I was going to raise an additional issue. I don't want to lose all this. You want to deal with the regulator now?
Yeah. Additional issue regarding?
No, it's a different matter.
Oh, no, no. Let's stay with the regulator now.
Shall I give you a few remarks to help move
yeah.
on? I don't think there's anything wrong with A or B or C, depending on, you know, how tightly we want to rewrite him. Wherever there are references to the minister, they should be references to Parliament, as in E, where we wanted to undertake research to monitor developments in IT and computer technology. But he or she must report to us. This is going to be an independent regulator after all. Examine proposed legislation, including subordinate, there you are, the regulator will be looking at other laws and subordinate legislation, and then he must report to us, not to the minister, and that's a jolly good idea, by the way, that this regulator should look at the other laws, in the same way that the Human Rights Commission keeps an eye on all law coming to Parliament. Under H, it shouldn't be when requested to do so to conduct an audit of personal information maintained by a body. You should be able to do that as of right, as in the case of the British thing I just cited. I'd like to ask in I, what are unique identifiers? Are they numbers, email addresses, what? May I ask the department that? And under N, what is a unique identifier under I?
Define a unique identifier. Chairman, I think that the thing where the world is moving toward, and this is a piece of legislation which will be in place for many years before somebody goes back to review it, it is obvious that there are trends in identifying people in new ways. There are programs to identify the way people walk. So there is, even without facial recognition, you can have a camera in the streets and identify people by their walk. There are the program of facial identification that we all know about, rating identification. I mean, who knows? In 20 years, people will be able to recognize, be identified by smell. My dog can do that. They will develop a machine to do the same. And all that require classifications of people by the way you walk, the way you move, the way you smell, and collection of data.
I mean, they're developing new devices for secure mail as we speak. And in technology, everything changes every 3 months. So don't try to catch anything which is the current technology doesn't work. You must do everything technologically new. So I don't think you need that clause. Surely it's captured by...
No, I think we do understand
Chairman, here there is a report into Parliament, which I think is good, because there is a bill of taking legislative, administrative, or other actions to give protection. So when there is a new technological means which can put place a threat, where from satellite they can identify anyone walking just by the way they walk, or they can, whatever it is, then this body needs to alert Parliament or the administration. And in this, we are providing for that which we do not know. So in this field, I'd rather be repetitive and put a few things which are pleonastic than falling short of covering what we still don't know how to identify and relate to.
I mean, if you call into the technology in here, which next December is going to be just old-fashioned, and the next thing will... All you need is a clause or a sub-clause. Which, like E, would just say to undertake research, monitor developments in information processing, computer technology, which constitutes restricted personal privacy or whatever you want. We'll find the word. And on that, they must report to Parliament with a view to any necessary legislative amendments or whatever. I mean, the regulator himself can change. That's why we're making him. He can keep up with the technology by making new regulations. That's what he's there for. So it's not us. We're not going to change the law every time. You write the law neutrally. You put in the principle, the legal principle, and he must do the work.
And he says from time to time.
He doesn't say it every day. From time to time. Report to Parliament. You know that. You know, one thing is... Once you want to give the regulator autonomy, they must also be accountable to somebody. Very, very critical. Any other thing, then you have a big problem. Like Mr. Mechanic, which I told all that review, created this thing called, let me not the way, I'll tell you the story of Mr. Mechanic one of time. Let's focus on this. So, I don't think we should be unduly worried about reporting to Parliament time to time. In fact, I don't think our debate is substantive on this one. So let's leave it in for now. Is it?
No, it's just a general structuring problem. I don't think 43 is particularly user-friendly. I mean, it's this long list. Goes from A to Z, and because we ran out of, they ran out of alphabet letters, they then had to do AA and DD. Right, after Z.
Oh, yeah,
okay. I think it would. No. I think it would be more useful to try and group the powers and duties into categories. and so to look at keeping largely what's here, but to group it so that the sort of advisory stuff is together, the enforcement stuff is together, and so on. So that's just one point. I think we need to look at, I mean, one thing I'm a little bit worried about is examine any proposed legislation that makes provision for the collection of personal information by any public or private body and the disclosure of personal information by one public or private body, blah, blah, and report to the Minister of Parliament. If that clause, I think that clause is important, but if it's going to work properly, there has to be sort of time limits. Otherwise, you're going to find a bill is published, the regulators need to know about it, and Parliament has processed it before the regulators got a time to respond. So, some kind of operational. Yeah, I'm not having a dialogue. I mean, you basically want the regulator to be able to make that input to Parliament before Parliament has finalised the legislation. So the operationalisation of that needs to be looked at. It's just a practical thing. But really, just those points. Then I think we need to also, I hear what Dean's saying about reporting to Parliament, not the Minister, though. I think we need to look at what is an executive function, what is a legislative function. Because we need to be careful about things that actually require executive attention being reported to Parliament, and there's actually nothing we can do about them, and we sit on them. So I just think just the sensitivity in that aspect.
Just on the previous point, there's no way you can bind Parliament when law is tabled and it deals with it. So it's not an issue. It's up to the regulator to spot legislation and to submit views, whether it's spotted when it's first presented by a minister or whether it's spotted when it's tabled here. If we're not saying you must. We're giving him the power to comment. Powers and duties.
The powers and duties of the regulator are to examine any proposed regulation. Power and duty is to examine. Look, I think it's a technical aspect. I think we're on the same page.
All right, but all I'm saying is there's no way if he neglects to do so, then we are going to stop legislating here. So it's not such a big problem. And this looks like the same as the Human Rights Commission has.
And
I suppose there are things you might want to report to a minister, but the essential point is that on an independent body has its relationship with us. It must account to us. It's our job to make sure they do their job. And it's to safeguard the independence that I say that it ought to report to us. I'm sure there are some, no doubt you will advise us what they are, some executive functions where it's appropriate to report to a minister. But what you don't ever want is for an independent body to be accountable to a minister. That doesn't work.
Chair, I just have two questions. Isn't G and U, isn't it almost similar? And then X, isn't that taking over the role of the review court? And because my concern is the regulatory function. What binding effect will X have? Yeah, that's my two questions.
Okay, thank you. I think I've been covered the whole question of drawing a distinction between executive and legislative functions. A concern at this stage will certainly be that we must keep in mind that the minister is still the government member responsible for the administration of the Act.
I don't want to answer some of the questions that were raised early on by about G and G, G and U.
G and U.
Yeah. That's what it used to be. G and U.
I think they could be collapsed into one section. And if we find another one to collapse into sections, we get rid of the AA and BB to annoy Mr. Jeffrey.
I think Dr. I mean, what I'd like to see is a categorization of the powers and functions to make it easier. Otherwise, I mean, I pity the regulator, and they've got to wade through these powers and duties the whole time.
Mr. Chair, interestingly enough, there was a categorization in the bulletin first by the South African Law Reform Commission, and drafting wise, it was taken out. But yes, if we look at the Law Reform Commission report, we do have a categorization where the powers and duties of the regulator, first of all, where it relates to education, will primarily be paragraph 8C, for example, monitoring and enforcement compliance, paragraph C, K. So there was an existing categorization, but during the final stages of the department promoting the bill and the certification of it, it was felt that the categorization should be taken out. But there is, and it can certainly the simple question is that we usually don't get that in our legislative text. So it's a question of consistency. And possibly the state law advisor assisted us would be able to add anything there if you would like. But if I remember correctly, it was a question of consistency with other texts.
So it's not decided. It's basically because it's not done. And now my argument would be it's actually easier reading having it like that. So the fact that it's not done, I mean, it reminds me of a story I heard at Waterproof Air Bases when they do a medals award, they paint this white block in front of the podium. And apparently where that came from was some person many years ago knocked over some paint to cover up knocked over the paint, they painted a white, nice white block. And then everybody else just saw this being done and they just repeated it. So we don't want that to be happening now. So it's basically a thing of consistency. I mean, you know, consistency will then go back to whereas and what are the clauses, you know, I don't like, you know, because that's consistent. Old style English, which reminds one of somebody standing on a roof shouting. But I think it's a question of for me, it would make sense that the bill needs to be reviewed. But unless somebody can come up with the state law advisors through you, Chair, I don't know, procedures from the state law advisors, whether he's got anything he wants to say.
To be fair to the department, the categorization was there, and that's why it was very clumsy, and drafting-wise, clumsy for the categorization. So we just had a combined list, and it's the practice that we use for the draft, so there's no other thing happening.
I hate dreamers, and JJ knows I do, but I do agree with him on this one. See, it's semantics, but it's neatening up of something that's potentially messy. And I'll give you the perfect example. M says to consult and cooperate with other persons and bodies concerned with the protection of personal information principles. And then O says to provide advice, with or without request to a minister or a public or private body on the object, blah, blah, blah. Quite frankly, it would be much neater to say to consult and cooperate with other persons and bodies concerned with the protection of personal information principles and to provide advice. I don't think you should say with or without request, because you should be providing advice at any time, the minister, regardless of what the minister says, to a minister or public or private body on the obligations under the provisions and generally on any other matter relevant to the operation of this Act. And there you go, you have one clause that's easier to understand and it neatens it up. And that
JJ would get rid of AA. So now we just need to find a few more things and then we get rid of CD.
It's not easy. You put I into E.
Yeah. And as Honourable Adam said, when I first read it, I disagreed with it, and I've read it about 10 times, and I do agree with it. G and U are the same thing. She's absolutely correct. Essentially, the only thing is G's longer than U. But all you need to say is U. So it's semantics. It's just neatening things up a bit so that it's easier for someone to read.
Maybe like that painting at Waterkloof. We should introduce the principle of simplicity. We must communicate what we our intentions, not camouflage our intentions in language, flowery language, and things like that. So let's start with this bill. Communicate nicely, straightforward.
What a terrible idea, Mr. Chairman. You're undermining 2,000 years of legal tradition. No, but there are technical reasons. You need to have a widow without request or advice, because usually advice calls for a request. But I would call for progress. And I think that the sentiments of the committee on these clauses are quite clear. First, we can move on and then see what comes back once our sentiments are captured.
We want to recapture our sentiments on just a summary of that. Generally, we are agreed on the regulator things. There are just two things that we seem to still be debating. It's the question of the role of the executive to some extent. That is reporting to the executive and to parliament. We are agreed on reporting to parliament. I don't think there's a mistake. If we agree also on reporting to the executive. So I think basically the rule seems to be it. Then we go for classification, we agree on with the law commission, and we proceed along those lines. Then get those clauses that repeat or expand on one and the other, capture the main substance of those in one and so sentences. Is that okay?
And the function clause, Mr. Chairman.
And there?
Function clause.
Yeah. Kristen, you end up.
23A.
Which respect are you returning reporting to the minister? It was a general discussion. But I think you were looking at to examine any proposed legislation into the subordinate legislative or the government and to report to the minister the results of that examination. Before, Kristen, you want to come in? You'll be having your hand up.
Yeah. I just want to clarify, okay, when you look at K, let me hang on, I'm not going to just clarify me. Are they talking about situations, for example, where you have this DNA bill or the fingerprinting thing where Home Affairs database can be then accessed or used by that? Is that what K is covering?
What?
Like a concrete example
in mind as to what that would cover. Yeah, I mean, that is a concrete example, but there's something else even which I now forget where or what it was. But by the way, Chair, it's very good that Christine reminds us of. I read that Marfa judgment that we heard about in England. I don't know whether you all read it. And since it's given by the European Court under the Convention, it's highly relevant to us. It carries the weight of an international judgment, it's not foreign law. And it has clear and direct implications for that fingerprinting and DNA bill that's gone to the police committee. And it's something, but it's also highly relevant to this law. In fact, it's quite a useful entry point into this whole law. I think we should all have a look at it. I'm not giving you a concrete proposal beyond that, but the short answer to Christine is yes, that is an example of where the regulator would make comment. But it's in fact a matter directly under his jurisdiction. He should be in a position to say, you can't do that. The police can't simply access other people's databases which contain personal information. And that Marfa judgment, in my view, certainly confirms that.
Okay, in a similar light, and I'm almost worried I'm going to be asking a stupid question because the answers are probably glaring, JJ. The answer's probably glaring me straight in the face. But under the duty of confidentiality, which is 47, to the person acting on behalf or under the direction of the regulator, but it doesn't at any stage say that the regulator must treat things with confidentiality. Now, what worries me is, and I use this purely as an example, so please don't think I'm trying to make a political point, but what if the Minister of Police and the regulator become good friends, and the Minister of Police decides he doesn't like JJ, which one couldn't blame him? So, what if they now decide that they don't like JJ, and the regulator gives the minister information on JJ, and then JJ has no comeback because in the act it doesn't say that the regulator must treat things with confidentiality because 47 only says a person acting on behalf or under his direction. But there's nothing that says the regulator must act with confidentiality.
Mr. Chairman, the regulator can only act through people.
Chair, I understand that. But what I'm saying is the regulator, because you could have a conversation with the regulator. And the regulator in conversation could give you...
No, I shall understand the concern.
Until the dreadful day in which machines will take over, you can only have a conversation with a person who will be acting on behalf or under the direction of the regulator. The regulator is the legal body.
You might have seen the transformer, Philip. Transformer. I didn't hear. I was busy talking. You have got a private conversation. Private conversations out of order. I haven't had the contact.
This committee is having more fun than allowed by law.
No, 47, yes. I think let's agree on the 47. That is Natasha's. It's not the inclusion that the regulator himself must be bound. Not only it will be law the regulator.
Sorry, before the department answers, can I? The state, sorry. What I'm saying is, what Honourable Amrutini said is absolutely true, God forbid the day that machines start operating as humans, the same day that the satellites start seeing how we move and as we are. But, Chair, what I'm saying is, the regulator will have access to computers and to documents, and he himself could get information on people. That's what I'm saying. I'm a conspiracy theory here. But seriously, what stops the regulator getting information about me and telling someone?
Yes, Chair. The way we understood it, Chair, is the regulator would be covered by a person acting on behalf of the regulator.
And the regulator
is
the
legal
one. Yes, sir. Good.
My worry is that legislation is meant to be easy to read. If somebody like Natasha is not clear, then who else is not going to be clear? And I'm sure there may be a way of phrasing 47 to cover that. So I think that is merit.
Then could be the regulator and then it continue any person on behalf or under the direction of the regulator, blah blah. The regulator at the beginning of the sentence, the regulator and then the sentence continues.
Yes,
sir.
Why don't we look now at our regulator under from 36 onwards? Oh no, 35 onwards. May I give you a remark? I approve entirely of clause 35. It is hereby established as the risk to be known has been either the Information Commissioner or the Information Protection Regulator, whatever, adheres to restrictions through the public care. Is independent, subject only to the Constitution and the law, must be impartial, performed, exercised, pierced, favourite prejudice, yes. Classic independent body formulation, must perform its functions, exercised in accordance with this Act, and the PIA, yes. Depending on what we do with it, yeah. Sure. Clause 36. Now, the proposal, and I'm sure we need to look at this one. The proposal is a chairperson and four. They're appropriately qualified, fit and proper. On account of experience as a practicing advocate, attorney, or a professor of law, or on account of any other qualification relating to the object of the regulator. And the first thing I would suggest is that we should maybe say that five people is probably okay, although the four should be full time, arguably. But perhaps we should think of saying that one half of them must be lawyers, and the others people with other qualifications relating to the objects of the regulator. If you don't want a situation where you end up with all other people, or even all lawyers. So maybe we should think about a number and how we split the requirements. Then under C, the chairperson must perform legal functions under the Act in a full-time capacity, must not be employed in any other capacity. The other members must be appointed in a part-time capacity. I'm not so sure about that. If we think of the people we met in Manchester, they had at least two deputy information commissioners. One was doing the fire, Christine, and the other was doing the other thing. But they had a big office full of people, and they said, think now of our own, what we've just looked at, function, powers, and duty, a lot of work. So do we not need five full-time? The chairperson must direct the work of the regulator and secretary, fine. No person will be qualified for appointment as a member of the regulator if that person is an MP or a councillor, mad or bankrupt. Should we include office bearers in political parties, or is that not necessary in this case? Do we want mad and bankrupt? Do we want mad and bankrupt or don't we? Anyway, there you go.
The bankrupt is there.
The bankrupt is a dishonesty. Should we have mad? I mean, it's the usual way. Then under two. Okay, and this is where we surely just revert to the section 193, which is the basis on which we have written all other independent bodies, which is basically members of the regulator must be appointed by the President on the advice of the National Assembly, or if you like, on the recommendation of the National Assembly. And all of the stuff after that must come out. I think we dealt with it the very first time we ever met with Anandani. We looked at it, and all of us said, what on earth were you doing with these provisions? Because they're not written as if for an independent body. What you basically want to do is look at section 193 of the Constitution. It's a good template. President, on the recommendation of the National Assembly, must appoint. And where's the provision about the committee? National Assembly must recommend persons nominated by a committee of the Assembly proportionally composed, approved by the Assembly by a resolution adopted by a supporter. But it's not a problem here. We just adopt it. And then for the removal, which here is dealt with under 7, member may be removed from office by the president on the recommendation of parliament only for, why don't we call it misconduct, incapacity and incompetence, after a finding to that effect and the adoption of a resolution by the National Assembly, which is also the constitutional template, rather than having the delicate infirmity of body or mind, misbehavior. What's wrong with misconduct, incapacity and incompetence? That format works. We all know it because we've built it into so many laws, and so many of our bodies are appointed and removed in that way. So, Chair, I would propose that's the way to go. And I would take out the entire clause 37 and first off 38, because I don't think that staff should be in the public service. Surely the chapter 9 staff are not, as far as I know, in the public service.
I mean, the one thing is that this is not chapter 9. We have to make a constitution to make it chapter 9 now. I know that the
NCOP gets quite jealous of its powers. The chapter 9 specifically accounts for the National Assembly. This says Parliament, so it includes the NCOP. I'm not quite sure how that works, though, in practice. I mean, I know when you go to the NCOP, we take this out, we don't want to put back in, unless we've got a good basis for saying no. Now, my question there would be, is there any other body that is appointed by Parliament, both houses? Because the difficulty you've got, what happens if they don't agree? That's for the clarification, that person is not appointed. You have a joint committee interviewing. So in terms of disarming ourselves or yourself when you go to the NCOP, and you get asked why was this taken out? Does the NCOP appoint anyone else? That would be the main thing. And then yes, I agree. Even though it's not a chapter 9, it could. I mean, look, we've got a problem generally with the way Parliament appoints, or the National Assembly appoints bodies, that it ends up being all over the place. Happen. So I don't have a problem with following the Chapter 9 provision. It basically does already, but the main difference is you've got Parliament, not the NCOP. I mean, not the NA. And as far as I know, NCOP does not participate in the appointment of provisions. You know, that is correct.
Mr. Chair, we will follow that up, indeed, because the original wording was a joint sitting of Parliament. So, and we were extremely concerned that was. But that was, and if I remember correctly, that was something that we said in the briefing that we would like to receive instructions on, is precisely this issue. But we will check for you. I doubt it. I think it's the National Assembly and that's it. But we'll be fine.
Can't answer that. I mean, joint sittings have no legislative or power, so they cannot take decisions. It has to be by both houses. Then you've got the problem, what happens if there's a dispute? Just to make my point. following on this matter of Parliament or National Assembly, and the powers in this is with respect to Parliament, is that affected at all? This desire to distinguish between Parliament and National Assembly? Here we are reporting the public, the regulator was reporting to Parliament. I disagree with Dean on this one. I think the purpose of under 37 of reporting to, look, I mean, it does things and it gives information to Parliament. I don't see why that information can't be to both houses. There's no problem with that. So if there's legislation which is going through both houses, And the regulator feels that there's some important point they want to make, why must they give it to us? And don't forget, NCOP represents the provinces. My main concern is appointment, that practically having it appointed by both houses is not possible. You can have them providing general reports to Parliament. I mean, at the moment with the Chapter 9, they don't report to the NCOP. But I don't think there's a contradiction between saying NA appoints and can remove, but they should also report generally to both. Let's not do it. Don't report to the NPOP. I'm not sure, and there may be problems there. I mean, the public protector should be able to report. I mean, at the moment, Auditor General has nothing to do with the NCOP, because there's no scope in the NCOP. That relates to the function there. But.
So now,
Is
the NCOP
doesn't represent provinces per se. It represents the provinces that they exercise provincial functions. Now, one of the most important provincial functions, even though completely unused, is the power over matters relating to consumer protection. So we need to discuss, I mean, think about, and I haven't thought about the extent to which this deals with the consumer protection. Sorry, this side of the room is freezing cold. If this bill deals with consumer protection, protection, Mr. Chairman.
To go on ahead, that's what the opt-in, opt-out stuff is all about.
It deals with consumer protection, so there must be an NCOP involvement, and therefore I think that the bicameral approach would be prudent.
In appointment or reporting, you mean?
In both.
No, because the problem in appointment is going to be, has it ever been done? Because practically, what happens if one house says one thing and the other house says another?
Yeah.
So
that's,
I think,
no way.
Now, we're dealing with basically 37. That's what is given right to all this non debate.
Okay.
I have to come back to that.
37.
I don't think let's select 37, because the 37. Well, are we agreed on this in 37? That's the issue I want to say. Don't lose flag it and move on.
Well,
I want to know what are the other options. I mean, let's say what's the situation? I mean, it's basically a thing of should they be under the public service or not. If they're not under the public service, then what are they under? And that would be my question. What are the implications?
Yeah. I think, Chair, somebody must just go and have a little look for us, if you don't mind. Look, by definition, if you're a full throttle Chapter 9 independent institution, it's inimical to have your staff through the public service. But a useful place to look is in our Chapter 9 review. And never forget that one of the most important recommendations we made in that report, and it's one that has already been noted by the Assembly, although not fully adopted, is that the budgets of these bodies must never go through a line ministry. In this, the Treasury agreed with us. The Minister Manuel and the Treasury agreed with us. The Parliament itself must start doing the budget for independent bodies and transfer and send their transfers directly through the parliamentary budget, because, and the argument is, the minute somebody's monies come through a ministry, they start getting treated like an agency under that ministry. That was our argument, it was the argument of Treasury as well. And that's what you need to look out for when you're dealing with an independent body. So that's the starting point. So Parliament, by appropriation, will look after these people. We have yet to discuss the question of cost recovery. If we allow them to charge fees for that, that's a little aside, charge fees for registering, for notification, then they at least half fund themselves. That's a separate subject. So we need to provide for their budgeting. Then their staff, the staff of an independent body ought to be staff appointed by itself. It is only logical. The minute you have public servants, you get into the whole Mendes de Milani syndrome, right? Whether something is an independent institution, or whether it is in the civil service and accountable to members of the executive.
Just
you
have to say
something? Looking at something on practical point of view, when we were looking at this Chapter 9, one of the big problems is that these institutions would have their staff processed all the time, because they can't afford to pay them the same kind of at the same level as government. So, you know, I agree with you that they obviously
they could be appointing their own staff, but then there must be some kind of protection or some kind of for what they can afford to pay them for their own skills.
Look, I think those are the aspects we need to be looking at. But I just wanted to address the question of deficit budget. The problem is, at this stage, the Chapter 9s are not even on deficit budgets. They do come through departments. So to say, no, with this one we are starting, when we haven't actually finalized the Chapter 9s, I think it's problematic. Then there's a whole lobbying process that goes on over the budget. The budgets get submitted, and then people go and they lobby Treasury for the money.
Okay.
Who's going to do that for this? I mean, Parliament's not particularly good at even lobbying. Parliament's not even particularly good at lobbying for itself.
Fair with respect, we now determine the national budget.
No. Wait, let me come on to that. Yeah. And then now remember that Parliament does have the power to amend the budget. So I'd want to sort of say that we leave it as is to the ministry. I think that's as it is, isn't it? But we do need to move on particularly starting with Chapter 9 of the separate appropriation. But my worry is to do something in theory, then find that actually they're worse off because nobody on this side is going to go and lobby for them. Or the people who are meant to haven't read the documents, etc., etc. Let it be through the department. We now can amend the budget as Parliament and appropriate some more money if we feel the department hasn't given them enough money.
Look, you're not going to actually deal with that in the law, but the current situation with the Chapter 9 is terribly patchy, if you'll remember. Some of them have, through convention now, developed, they go directly to the Treasury and defend their own budget requests. And by the way, the Constitutional Court said, in so many words, it is for Parliament to make sure that the people have the money they need, and I think it even said that they must be able to come and defend their budget requests to Parliament. It's Langeberg, the municipality version. And so some Human Rights Commission, I'm not trying to remember who has what, but some by convention developed the habit of directly defending to Treasury, and they were happier campers. Others are just neglected. They send to the ministry what they want. Nobody ever talks to them. The minister doesn't particularly go and defend to the Treasury. Some figure comes down, and they get what they get. It's highly unsatisfactory. I don't anyway think that a law is where we deal with this. We will come to say Parliament will appropriate, and then later on we'll decide whether they will also have the money. That's the more important decision, whether they can raise money through those notifications and then have their own kitchen to make them more independent and reduces the burden on the taxpayer. That's worth looking at, notwithstanding the fact that I previously argued against it. But so I think all we need to do here is to say it will be funded by money appropriated by Parliament, which is what it does. And then later we'll decide, do we add some cost recovery? The other thing I was registering at too says, the regulator may, with the approval of the minister, consultation with finance on a temporary basis or for a particular matter. That doesn't sound right, because they shouldn't have to run up and down to ministers to employ people with... That's really wrong. That's 38.2.
That is more on an ad hoc basis where you deal with an exceptionally difficult case, for example, and you need someone with a special knowledge. One could nearly compare it to on an ad hoc basis appoint consultants.
Are you comfortable with the heat level? Is it too cold, too warm? Nice.
It's good, it's nice.
Right. Well, yep.
You're driving us
a bit hard. No, I'm not. It's weird. I thought today I was very, very, very.
Because they are not allowing people to talk. Yeah. Let's go on.
Thank you, Tina. I would just like to ask you that with indulgence for about 5 minutes break.
No, let's get a break. Let them go and smoke, please. They shall smoke. They are here. 5 minutes. Okay, let's be compact. On Tuesday in the afternoon, we think it might be short or long, but depending, it's the first reading of, it's not the first reading. Let's get back to business. Let's conclude this part on the regulation. Identify areas of agreement. I think page 5 we are agreed on.
Okay, it was a B. The appropriately fit and qualified fit and proper person. Now, I don't understand the practicing advocate or attorney or professor of law at the university. And then there is a general, any other qualification. But it's so specific on the law issue. Now, I'm not sure why this emphasis on lawyers. Presumably, it would be that, okay, you want lawyers because codes are going to be drafted and need to be checked. Now, if you take in here, or if you take a number of the officials from the Department of Justice, I don't know about Ananda, Christine, I think would fall flat into this. They can't be appointed to the regulator in this category. They would only have to be on account of other qualifications. But from the legal point of view, they can't. You might find a legal drafter is really good and would be able to examine a code greatly, but because they haven't practiced as an attorney or advocate, they can't. I just wonder why they're so specific with that. So what I'm basically saying is, I think let's look at the intention. There need to be some lawyers, but not to be as restrictive as a practicing attorney or advocate or professor of law.
I disagree. I think the reason why it's usually like this is because that gives you a kind of independence. The person who has set up his own practice is an advocate, is an independent animal, an attorney in a different way. But I think that's the intention. An academic is supposed to be independent. Hello, madame, how are you? Supposed to be independent anyway.
The term only a non-lawyer would say that an advocate, an attorney is independent.
Well, I hesitated for a minute and then I decided not to.
Your time. Now, Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree with the Honorable Secretary. There is an overemphasis on lawyers. Lawyers, after all, are people with no quality. I mean, we have no, I mean, our knowledge is the conventional knowledge. It is the way it is because we determine to be that. And that doesn't necessarily make us experts of life, society, economics, or the world at large. Ours is an artificial world which is self-defined. So I think that a lawyer, whether practicing or not practicing, but I would say a suitably qualified lawyer is required as part of the membership. So I would rather a language that says that members of the regulator must be a properly qualified, a fitting person for appointment, on account of experience and training, comma, and must include a suitably qualified lawyer. So if one of them is lawyer, the others could be taken from other walks of life, the great people or engineers. I mean, you see, one of the fascinating things, we're all victims of the Western world we live in. But look at China and look how well it's doing. Look at their parliament. They're all engineers. All their legislators are engineers. All their government, most of their government is made of engineers. And they get on with the work.
Yeah, I've actually come to that view after many years of working in electronic communication. I think engineers are great and should run the world. But, Chad, this something Mark Haynes just we were talking about outside, there was something. He was asking me what the British commissioner, what kind of expertise it has, communications and computer expertise, I can't remember. But I was actually saying outside that we shouldn't be writing into the law anything like that. But I wonder now. I wonder if we shouldn't stipulate at least one commissioner or member here with knowledge of electronic systems because I think we should. Because that really is what it's all about. And when you're dealing with breaches and whether people have appropriate security in their computer systems, I think in fact we should. How would we phrase it? Expertise in the field of...
May I interpolate, Mr. Chairman? On that point, I think we should say a suitably qualified lawyer and a suitably qualified scientist. I would it's not scientist in the relevant discipline. Today we are at the tail end of the IT technology. There is another revolution which will dwarf the IT technology, and that's the bio-industry technology. When I say that people will be able to be recognized by smell, I mean, it's not absurd. You're going to a specialized genetically engineered enzyme which will be able to do almost anything and will merge with nanotechnology. Most of things will operate at this level. So suitably qualified scientists with relevant expertise and training.
No, but we are doing chairperson. No, it's still electronic engineering because what we're dealing with is computerization and data banks and information. So it's still the engineering.
I just think we're being too detailed. Mm-hmm. I think we're being too detailed at this time. Let's just say relevant, appropriate experience. In other words, a person who would be qualified would look into relevance with respect to the experience expertise. Yeah. But not really go to the profession.
It's a therapy. The issue of lawyers already here. And I think it's wonderful. On the are we saying perfectly qualified business person for appointment at least one or two needs to be a lawyer and
they need to be a lawyer. You could also say, yeah. You could also say, at least one of the needs to be a lawyer. And,
but you see, Tim, I worry with the others is that extended.
It's what it's doing, though. It's what it's doing.
Whereas the law is you would need at least one lawyer. I mean,
Patricia.
Thank you. I've been trying to give
her
a
Bible.
It's
time for this. I just want to maybe mention that we should take into consideration, and we started here at this stage, we've got two components in the office of the regulator. We've got the members, and also very important at this stage, but we just keep it in the back of our minds. They are not present, right, number one. Number two, you've also got your officials, if I may call them that. Now, the example that Mr. Jeffrey indicated that you might have the need for a drafter, for example, might not qualify as a member. We must keep in consideration, these are only the members of the Office of the Regulator. They are on a temporary basis there. The reason for them having to be legally qualified is that they are going to take decisions not only of an administrative nature under PAJA, so they must have that knowledge. They are also going to lead investigations taking place. If we look at the powers and functions, and I don't want to go into too much detail there, it is strictly speaking necessary for at least or the members of the be well qualified members of the legal fraternity practicing. If that option is not exercised, then one would fall back on the situation, I presume, and that will take place during implementation. If whoever becomes the regulator will immediately identify the need for legally qualified person, he will then beef up his or she. Their office, the office of the regulator, by appointing officials. The only question now is, in my mind, is whether you would like to have the person that makes the final decision on how this office operates as the person who is well aware of all the legal pitfalls, or whether you're going to have a regulator not necessarily legally qualified, but you will have your staff component beefed up with either the qualified person. I don't know if one would even like to, if the committee would like to stay with the temporary members, retired judges.
Trained in law is required. But at the same time, the paragraph goes on to say, on account of any other qualification. Doesn't that mean that we can have other members of the regulator who are not necessarily lawyers, who will be in a position to carry out the objects of the regulator? So why are we delivering it? Since that this, we can have lawyers, we need to have lawyers,
yeah,
and other people.
Yeah, I think the issue you are raising is if you want to specify at least one lawyer up to four, and then the rest can be no lawyers and 45 people, but we're not going to list high education, nano scientists, bio, whatever, I don't know, but so we have to have a lawyer.
Right, let's pass it on that note. That's it. Lectures.
And then Captain Bill, for the rest, if we follow the provisions of Chapter 9, as far as
which is the
yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay. 37?
Just on that point, and
where are you?
Official, yes.
On 37, I would agree with Honorable Smart that the members of the regulator shouldn't be members of, shouldn't belong to the Public Service Commission. I mean, to the Public Service, shouldn't be covered by the Public Service Act. But the staff, their conditions and their conditions and other benefits of service can be provided for under the Public Service Act. I don't think it would affect the independence of the regulator as well. But the members of the regulator themselves should be under the Public Service Act. Their independence should be separate. But 37 should remain, but only the part that deals with them being subject to provision of the Public Service Act should be excluded from this. Because the minister...
So you'll come back to the issue of protecting and poaching and so on. The thing you raised there, you know? Earlier on you talked about people being poached from the airport. Somebody did. Oh yeah, Christine raised it, yeah, but he's talking about staff now.
No, but he's saying he agrees with the scheme making public service for staff. Yeah. So 37 is about the five members of the regulator, and that they should not be subject to the public service.
We're agreed on that. Yeah, so 37 were agreed that there won't be, that is, members of the regulator. The actual members are not going to be public servants. It's effectively a chapter 9. We're trying to create a body close to or a chapter 9 body.
Chair, that is simply beyond doubt. In fact, the Constitution, if I can remember, the Constitution requires, you know the independent, what used to be the Mosinete Committee? That is supposed to make recommendations not only for us and the executive, but also for the members of the Commission. That is 214 or something. It's in the Constitution. So it's not even a discussion for independent bodies, and we follow the template. But still, I don't think the staff should be civil servants either. I mean, these people are supposed to be an independent body. And I think it's still worth, if things go, and I will just go and check for us with ICASA and the Human Rights Commission, and especially the IEC, which is the best one of them all. I mean, the IEC takes on lots of people at election time, but the smaller establishment, the permanent establishment of the IEC. Just check what are their, what is the employment status of their people.
All right, then. Yeah.
May I just let this slide to you? And purely on a practical point, with regard to secretary and staff, the advantage that one always has, if the president signs this bill and it's the responsibility of the minister, the DG is always in a position to immediately designate the person to get that office up in the name. If you do not go that route, and I'm just talking about purely implementation, I personally think, and I haven't got much experience in coordinating implementation, but I personally think it might make things a bit difficult if you have to go through a whole appointment procedure just to get people doing the administrative functions on the office of the regulator in place. That will take time. That will have its same effect on the implementation of the Act. So the department which is responsible for the implementation of the Act will only be able to reach a certain stage, and then that process will be delayed waiting for the appointment. I wanted to approach on two points before you close the meeting on this thing, but just reacting to what Hank was saying. See, I'm concerned about the notion of deployment from the department, and it's correct, that's how it always happens. The director general looks at a few people in the department and appoints to a new body, territory established. It happens often that the people who are not desperately needed within the department and not necessarily the most suitable, competent, and desirable. So I warn against that approach, and I tend to agree with Dean in looking at the issue. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I would like to address you on Section 42, which is a source of great concern for me. Section 42 makes the regulator as a legal entity not liable in law for anything inefficient, stupid, or outrageous he does, for as long as he does it in good faith. And on the other side of this indemnity, which is really unheard of, there are people who are being damaged and whose constitutional rights in terms of Section 24 to judicial redress of their grievances are hereby being curtailed and obliterated. I mean, we should make, in terms of Section 195 of the Constitution, we should make the civil service of those working for organs of state more accountable, not less accountable. So I would really plead for this entire section to be eliminated.
We'll come to that. Let's conclude the debate. Yeah. Since you just jumped to, you get the platform and move to the next one. Oh, let's go back to the
debate.
Let's go to the debate.
Are we merely deleting the words who is not subject to the provisions of the Public Service Act 1994, Proclamation Number 1 of 1994, which will indicate that we are not contemplating the employment of the visitors? Or are we going to go further and think categorically that they may not?
Look, I think that if we are going and we don't want...
You don't want civil servants, you've got a section, and we say so under 36F, which is no members of the legislature. The intention is a full-time chair, so obviously there won't be anything else, and then four part-time members. I think the thing to look at would be, that if it's independent, are they going to be independent if they are public servants as well? And that's the issue. I'm not particularly comfortable with public servants because it is a regulatory body. But if we are going to put it in, we need to put it in there, and we need to take out the not subject to public service because that implies that there can be. But that's maybe something to flag for final decision making. Then my point was on the secretariat. I mean, going back to 38, that I think that I mean, just on Dr. Ambrosini's point. I mean, look, I think and taking what Henk had said. I mean, I think let's get the information. Let's, again, we're not finalising things now. Let's get the information that Dean wanted. But I think, for example, that the courts are independent. The magistrates, the judges are dealt with by the Commission for the Remuneration of Public Office Bearers. But the staff of the court are public servants, are they not, as far as I'm aware. And the issue that we would need to be looking at is more... they might be appointed in terms of the Public Service Act, but who appoints them? And to give basically the commission the power to appoint the secretary, and then the secretary the power to appoint staff. But I think it's an appointment thing, so that Dr. Ambrosini's problem of staff simply being shunted across, your secretary here, Dr. Ambrosini, other people, some just moved across, and the commission then has to just put up with them. But that may be the way to deal with it.
Actually, may I just add to that? And I don't want to start kicking a dead donkey if a final decision will be made on this, but one should take into consideration, and this is purely a practical consideration. It's much easier. In the public service, you've got your salary scales, you've got your responsibilities added to that. Now, if it is expected of a regulator to establish an office where he or she must, first of all, determine what the salaries of those people are, what their responsibilities are going to be, it's going to place an enormous administrative burden on him or her, where it is simple to...
I think the point is made. You made it earlier on. God says he hasn't given the last kick anyway. So might be dead, but we're coming back because what I understand, I remember to be saying we're going to do a bit of Goma conducting. Right? And then we have flagged the issues, we have just highlighted what are the possible scenarios. But we need to go and do a bit of work, come back to finalize the case. Christine, I don't want us to debate this longer than now. Yeah, please come in.
One of the problems with when we look at the chapter 9 is about the pay scale. So, and the recommendation was that the Parliament looks at that. So I think that perhaps the committee could look at whether we want the minister to determine the pay scale and so on. So if we could just maybe flag that as something to look at. The alternative could be Parliament, that that's the problem in the end up with a committee having to determine.
The section of the Constitution I was referring to earlier is 2195. National legislation must establish frameworks for determining salaries, allowances, benefits, and status, public protector, auditor general. Members of any commission provided in the Constitution, including the broadcasting regulator, etc. And then the shameful truth is that it wasn't done for them for years, and Parliament and its committees, Justice, Communication, Home Affairs. Nobody looked after these bodies properly. Eh? Nobody looked after their remuneration. They were tearing their hair out years before their remuneration and packages were properly looked after. But something is now in place, and maybe we could latch onto that, I don't know, because they are capitalized after all. And the truth is, they all set up their own establishments. I'm asking for the homework to be done because I don't want to say it so when I haven't looked at it for years. But many of those bodies all set up their own staffing. You actually can't transfer civil, you can't transfer from our ministry. They set up their own staff. Some of it was a spectacular mess, and I want to address you under clause 41 on something pertaining to the messes.
When
you say I'm late.
Before you go on, just a minute.
I'm getting very lost. I thought we had settled. And I thought we were flagging 38 to go and do homework. That's what I thought. I thought we were there. So we're going back. So I'm not going to go into further discussions on 37. What I'll do, I'm going to flag it. We'll come back to it. Subject it to the same as 38. And then we just forward. So the 837 flag in terms of the final, but for different reasons. We haven't debated the issue of whether the minister or not. That's what was intended to debate 37. So we'll require that as something to be debated finally. Then 38 is a question of taking the appropriateness and practicality of the civil service vis-à-vis the other people. And that homework needs to be done. So I'm closing it at that. I'll come back to that. Right. Let's move to 39. Let's go to 39. Okay. If there are no comments on 39, we move to the next. Yeah, 39.
Thank you. I don't know what on earth the working committee is. The regulator may, if it considers it necessary for the proper performance of its functions, establish a working committee. Which must consist of such members of the regulator as the regulator may designate. Such other committees. Just give them the right to establish committees and clause. B, such other committees as it may deem necessary and which must consist of such members as the regulator may designate, such members of the regulator as the regulator may designate, persons appointed by the minister? No. There is no way the minister gets involved in the actual operations of an independent body. So the minister comes out under Roman 2 completely. But even the matter of the establishment of committees, surely, sir, all we need to give them is as much as you need in law to make it possible to set them up. And under 2, the minister may at any time extend the period of appointment referred to in sub 1B2? And no, absolutely not. Once you've established the body, they must run their own affairs. They must not be in a position where they have to run to a member of the executive for this, that, and the other. And three, the regulator must designate the chair, and if the regulator deems necessary, vice chair of a committee. I'm sure that's fine. And subject to the directions, perform functions. I'm sure that's fine. Any functions that perform deemed to be fine. The regulator may at any time dissolve. Item for section 40.
I think we needed to collapse one and two in a single provision, which reads the regulator may, if considered necessary and for the proper performance of his function, establish one or more committees, which must consist of such members as the regulator may designate. Such member of the regulator as the regulator may designate. That's all we need.
That's all.
And then a B comes out and two comes out.
To consider the minister doesn't come in. If that's in line with all the chapter 9 institutions, comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Then we close. Let's go to 14. The regulator may regulate.
The chairperson of the regulator is the accounting authority for the regulator for purposes of the CMF Act. Now, one of the basic reasons why many things went very wrong at many Chapter 9 institutions, we only discovered after a few years. And that was a lacuna, sometimes in their statutes, but predominantly in the CMF Act, which was a hole that was later plugged by Trevor Manuel. What you have to say is that the chairperson of the regulator, or your five regulators, are the executive authority of this body. And under the CMFA, it is usually the CEO who is the accounting officer. Right? Because a lot went wrong at more than one body because the CEO saw themselves as the person who ran the place. And you therefore had a standoff and almost two factions forming between the commissioners and what is effectively the staff. And so it's very important. I think it's a problem we have in the Human Rights Commission Act too. There's a need to establish that they are the executive authority. So in this case, we must decide either the chairperson of the regulator is the members are the executive authority, and the accounting officer is surely a CEO. Surely what we should be putting into 38 is that they appoint a CEO, who in turn appoints the CFO and the COO, if necessary, and they appoint their staff. And that is the accounting officer under the CFO.
Okay.
That is that. Move to what, 41? Any comment? Happy to start 41. 42 I've dealt with earlier on. Much extensively. But come in,
is it? No, 42 not 42. Yeah, 42 is the point about being vague.
Where we actually, what are we saying about it? I mean, he objects to the fact that they won't be civilly or criminally liable if they acted in good faith. I suppose refer to the release of information and so on. Is there anything? It's very nice for the regulator to have this clause, but is there any similar provision somewhere else? Why do we have this clause?
So may I clarify, Mr. Chairman, this applies in respect of anything. If you go in the office of the regulator and something falls on your head, you get injured. Or they anything happens, it's in the performance of their function. If we do not have an immediate answer at this stage, we would like to bring that information because I'm aware of similar provisions in other legislation. The concern that one has at this stage is that you are going to attract personal liability for an official function that you perform. And that is just something that we would like to follow up at this stage. The object falling on your head, example, that is debatable. I don't think throwing objects around in the office of the regulator forms part of functions of duty. But we would like to with your permission, come back with more information in that regard.
On that, maybe not immediately, but
about
checking the official from the regulator.
No, I mean that's vicarious liability, but that's not the thing that we would just like to come back with more information. But I suppose there's a bigger difference between vicarious liability and something related directly to any of these. But this is not what the section speaks about. It speaks about the liability of the regulator, so it's not a matter of vicarious liability. Vicarious liability is a breach that goes from the individual to the institution. This affects anything which lands on the institution, other than means of vicarious liability or by means of direct liability. The institution is not liable for what it does. And if somebody sends you a virus, in good faith, sends you a virus and your entire computer system breaks down because they need to send communications, they're not liable. And it's against the spirit of Section 195 of the Constitution, which warns an accountable civil servant.
Well, I think that you look for more information and can come back. Then we can debate it. Partly because we are saying, we have not settled the issue of whether it's a civil service or not in any event. But my understanding is Chapter 9. And we should look at those answers in that context, because that issue of settlement about the nature of this regulator is in Chapter 9.
Okay, let's move to 43.
then it's going to
44. You are happy with 34?
I would put it somewhere else.
What, 34?
44, because it says see how the regulation works. So I would have put it almost like nearer, yeah, maybe go to that. If I can't get that, that's what I'm going to do. If I can't get that, that's what
I'm going to do. Jefferson is in C, in 2 sub C. Take account of the international obligations accepted by South Africa. International technology of communications. That's extremely clumsy. Let's call it the field of electronic communications. I mean, what you're talking about is the ITU agreements and rulings, but there are separate ones for the computer industry under ICANN and other agencies. But I don't know any such expression as the international technology of communication. So just call it the field of electronic communications, and which reminds me, Chair, that I agree with all the people who made submissions who said that in the definitions clause, there's reference to public communications networks, which is not an animal any of us have ever heard of, and all the definitions should come straight out of the Electronic Communications Act, the ECA, because we made all new definitions. And everybody now works on them for both for the network and for the service. And besides, all the laws should speak to each other.
But should the law just limit that, take cognizance of South African international obligations?
You could do that too.
Done it. Simple, straightforward.
Absolutely.
And good. Any other law that we pass in the country has to talk in America. Let's go to 15, the section elsewhere. It's a matter of, I'm sure we can suggest that maybe Honorable DG might want to. You still deal with content?
Yeah, but I have a brain tired. I shouldn't have gone to the movie last night. Except it was Zimbabwe. It was very brilliant. A movie about Zimbabwe. Chair, let's look at 15. In performing the in performing its functions in terms of 43.1K, with regard to information matching programs. Now, why are we lavishing so much attention on matching programs? It's only one of the phenomena now occurring, and different kinds of phenomena are about to occur. Why a whole section on matching? I mean, it's been one of the interesting manifestations of the availability of databases and information. So why so much on matching?
Department?
Sorry, I'm just looking at our definition of information matching program.
Why that's a specific area that
but it's the biggest effect of the whole is one explosion, that if you are now able to put all the different things together of a person at this point with all these information, which would usually have been in separate from each other.
Ananda, it cost us to 43.1k, which is about examining any proposed legislation that makes provision for the collection of personal information. Sorry, what? Which two? Oh. Yeah. Okay, I'll have to read this again. But it just seems to me, yeah, we should be technologically neutral. You see, I mean, I think we just lay down the principles and let the regulator then work with them. Can I leave that for the moment?
Okay. Let's have that. That is 44. We'll dispense with his funder note. Then we're going to 45. Happy with 45. Something on 45? Oh, we're tired. We're at 45. I don't think it's a crisis. Let's leave it till then. Let's keep it. Yes, it's in. Right, let's go to 46. Happy with 46. Very alleged, Minister. Honorable Dick. But let's say generically we are agreed that as a chapter 9 is. We'll look at every amendment. Yeah, you want to come?
I mean, it's not a chapter 9. Chapter 9 is the Constitution.
Oh, yeah.
So I think we need to be clear on
yeah.
What we were looking at is the movie of the King. And the chapter 9 is due to report by written to the province, not the people. But the other bodies do. So here it is.
What do you say? What do we say? Okay, let's leave it as it is. Good. Including what we have. Yeah, they've got to be there. Okay. Right, that's in place. Now, we have dealt with the regulator. Do we still go on? Yeah. Yeah, we've agreed on finishing with the regulator today. Any other thing we'll do next week? Christian?
Perhaps it would be helpful. helpful to start deciding where what you want to look at next week in terms of preparation. I don't know. That's
okay. Yeah, let's see what is the start next week. What are we suggesting about next week?
Okay, you I think we're wanting to run through the rest of it. The whole day. I mean, I would have thought we could have pushed on a little bit more because we've got things the regulator does, which I don't think is too controversial now. On top of 12, I was the one who was complaining about having a meeting at 2, but it's, why don't we go on for another half hour or whatever? But I think for next time it would be, I mean, particularly this issue of the reordering. And I think the general consensus was we not necessarily in this order. We have the regulator, we does certain things like investigation, we've gone through the code. The code then must be consistent with the general principles, the 8 general principles. And what do we put there so that they remain principles without becoming more detailed than principles? What are the then exclusions and exemptions that need to be followed by the regulators in drawing up the code? The one issue so there's a number of issues that come up there. And there's a lot of things. So I think one would be the structuring, but I think the key thing is probably going to be around what is excluded and what isn't. And that's things for people to talk about. But maybe it's also useful to have the public, the summaries of the public submissions on those elements as well. Okay, what is your talk to them?
Yeah,
well, that's the general exclusions, and then I'm talking about all the stuff in the exemptions, basically. So the part B, I mean, how that is dealt with, and it would be then, it would be basically, I think the key thing is going to be clause 4 exclusions, and then the part B. Part B stuff, which would also be a guide to the or something that the regulator has to follow. And then I think there's one aspect of which I just seeing the person, I think from the one data collection body that made submission. And that is, if people, and I'm still not clear about it, if information is already in the public domain, is there a problem somebody collates?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah,
so
it's a question.
Yeah, because if people have already consented to information, let's take the telephone directory.
Yeah.
You get asked, do you want to be in the telephone directory or don't you? And if you don't want to be in your lobby, if somebody were to take the telephone directory and present a public document and collate stuff there, is that a problem? And let's say any public document, newspapers, stuff like that. So that's the thing I'm concerned about. Would like us to look at more detail, and I'm just more raising it as a question because I think that's their issue, and I've got sympathy for their issue. If you have consented to the release of information publicly, is there a problem with that being collated?
Let's note that these questions are not raised for this meeting.
Yeah.
They are to identify what they're going to be
discussing.
Under clause 25 and 26, processing of special personal information, the prohibition. Now, I've already said that I am Natasha, I believe we should just delete the whole thing. But I think there is a need to deal with two subjects. by the way, on the politics and the religion, I would go for the UK approach. But there are two subjects which probably will need a clause each. And I would think they are health and crime. You don't have to deal with them somehow. And all I want to ask is this. If I forward the MARPA judgment to Bonani for distribution to members, would you very kindly consider having a look at it? It's the case about fingerprints and DNA, and I do think that ruling is relevant to us, and maybe we should even incorporate something here. And I think we need a section on whatever they call it, criminal stuff.
Of 2 days ago in the newspaper that they're actually taking fingerprints now on awaiting trial detained. So I'm not just sure that they're under the fingerprints and they're having convicted.
Interesting.
It's criminal conduct rather than criminal conduct. Thank you.
I think we're sufficiently clear of what needs to be done in terms of preparation.
Okay.
You know what? I noticed some members have had. It has been intense. Come back. Next week we won't go to New York.